Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is A. Kendra Green. She's a writer and artist who has worked at several museums throughout her career, and we're talking about her new book, The Museum of Whales You Will Never See, and other excursions to Iceland's most unusual museums. Kendra, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to be talking to you about this book.
And it's a pleasure to be here.
There were times when I was reading this book, I literally felt I was dreaming. I don't know how to explain it. It was a very oneric experience, your writing, which is wonderful. And I mean that in the best, most positive way. Why Iceland? How did you end up in Iceland?
You know, it was kind of an accident. I wasn't one of those people who had the sense to fall in love with the sagas early or be excited about it.
There are people like that? There are people who fall in love with the sagas early? Wow.
It's one of the things I discovered. I've been researching this book since 2011, and there's a whole class of PhDs in English literature of a certain era, right? Most of them are emeritus at this point, They took the trouble to learn Icelandic because as long as they knew Old English, they might as well read the sagas. This was just too important a thing to miss.
Well, you know, I've traveled around the world and I have a really poor facility for languages, but I haven't gone to Iceland yet. And I can tell you right now from reading the introduction to your book, I'm going to have a real problem with Icelandic. I like how there's like even letters that have different names, like the letter Thorn and the letter F. It's like Dr. Seuss's On Beyond Zebra. I mean, did you know Icelandic when you went?
I definitely didn't, and I am not as far along that path as I would like to be even now. But I feel like this is a good opportunity to teach you two of my favorite Icelandic words.
Okay.
All right. Well, you should know Ísruntar, which is a word that means specifically to go get ice cream and drive around. And you should know the word, and I'm still not perfect on my pronunciation here, okay, but Shalaki, which is
Shalaki?
A whale stranding.
Oh, wow.
It's written with an HV. There's an L in there, but Shalaki means, it's sort of a benediction, right? May a whale get stranded on your beach. May some unexpected piece of good
luck. I don't want to wish that on a whale. No, no, I'm pro cetacean. No, I don't want to wish a whale stranding on any whale. Now, maybe in Iceland, they would depend on it. Yeah, that would be a great thing in Iceland. I'm sure historically they would depend on it. And that's one of the things, by the way, I learned from your book, which has so much information in it, is that the history of Iceland is really the history of really a hard luck culture. There were so many things historically that happened to the Icelandic people. There were famines, there were plagues, and you know, it's a tough place to make a living anyways. But then there were also volcanic eruptions. And so it was interesting, especially towards the end of your book, how the topic of poverty in their history comes out. And not today. We're not talking today. But we're talking about relatively recently history. People were living pretty close to the bone in Iceland.
For a long time. And, right, it's not surprising if you think about the period of time which it was under Danish rule, right? Never really a good idea to be a colony. But there's
especially
just,
to Denmark. I mean, really?
Right, and then to be a place that, I mean, it's a lot warmer than you'd think it is.
Yeah.
But it still has a very short growing season. Not a lot of things do well. But basically, your best bet is to plant the things that will feed your sheep, right? That's
wow.
What you're doing.
I'm definitely not making fun of their poverty and their history, but I mean, there was a time you wrote about that people would have a spoon. That was the spoon that you would pass down to your beloved ones when you died.
Right. It was an important heirloom. And these spoons, they're really beautiful, right? If you have them made out of horn, right?
Sheep, yeah, cow, yeah, yeah.
They're sort of translucent and ethereal, but they're also, practically speaking, a thing you have to be careful with because they'll melt, right? They'll get sort of bendy if the soup is too hot.
Now, this book is about the museums in Iceland. And as a person who worked almost all his life in an art museum, I found this book fascinating. There are only 330,000 people in Iceland, yet there are 265 museums and public collections.
Maybe more, right? The it's a hard.
Well, you did miss that whale museum, and we're not going to we're not going to give that away. We're not going to talk about that other than you didn't get to see it.
Although I love that in the fact checking, one of my Icelandic friends said, "Look, here's the address for the appendix. I don't know if that'll help you get there, but someone might."
So how when I'm reading your book overall, and we're going to get to some specifics later, I really start to understand the sort of the evolution of museums worldwide by looking at Iceland. I mean, there are all these museums, not all of them, but an awful lot of the ones you went to, there are all these idiosyncratic, very personal collections that essentially got out of hand.
And I think it's a perfect microcosm, right, that it tells us about this very broad story through things that don't happen anywhere else.
Yeah, and the collections are just so strange. Like, I want to start talking about one for an example. We're not going to talk about all of them. And trust me, you need to read this book because the writing is the pleasure, too, of this book. Petra's Stone Collection.
That's a good one.
I love that story. How did it start?
So Petra, and people sometimes ask if that was her real name. She was named after the midwife that came when the doctor couldn't make it in time on Christmas Eve. And this woman went on a walk most every day. She was from Eastern Iceland, a town that at its peak was maybe in the 400 people range and is now a little less than 200. And she was the sort of person who, on her walks every day, was really likely to find a stone most of those days. And this part of Iceland, the edges, the Vestfjords and the eastern coast are the oldest parts of Iceland, right? The first part to kind of bubble up from the earth. And she would find, right, jasper and onyx and opal and obsidian and bring it home. And it was a little house. There wasn't a lot of room really quickly. But the great thing about collecting stones is you can leave them outside. And once you do that, it's really easy there's one road that goes through town. If people can look into your garden, they'll notice this accumulation, right? Things filling up shelves, going around the flagpole, and eventually pushing back up the hill.
Now, for me, the strange thing is, when did this sort of swim into being a public attraction?
I'm fascinated by the fact that collections have a starting point, right? We can always find the first thing. When does that happen? But when things become museums, it's so much more amorphous, right? This border can be hard to pin down. For Petra's Stone Collection, people were coming to visit, right? The family starts a guest book really early. It's mostly neighbors and friends, but slowly people are coming from farther and farther away. And at some point, tour buses start coming. Right, there are tours coming and having a busload of strangers walk through the garden for years and years. Right, tour guides in the kitchen over coffee telling Petra, "You have to charge admission," and she refused until the day that somebody walked in and asked her, "Where's the bathroom?" And she pointed to it, and they said, "No, that one's busy. There's got to be another one." And she said, "No, there's just the one." And the stranger, right, this tourist walking into her house said, "What kind of museum has only one bathroom?"
Wow.
As a woman that never took money for people coming to visit the gems that she brought down from the mountain or up from the sea, did feel she could start charging admission to build a fund so they could build two bathrooms, which are very conveniently still available to you when you go to visit the garden.
Now, there's this beautiful garden and this huge collection of stones. I think the weird thing is the way that you describe it, it became a museum in spite of itself. She didn't want it to become a museum originally. It's just it's almost like you would build it and they will come. And that's what she did.
And without even meaning to build it, right? She didn't
think
of herself as even owning the stones, right? They were just sort of being borrowed, right? The thing you bring forth to look at for a while. And it was really sort of late in her life and her collecting, and after the museum was established, that she realized the stones weren't going anywhere.
I think the amazing thing is that she was so sanguine with busloads of people just suddenly turning up. Can you imagine that in America? I mean, it's like you have a collection, and all of a sudden a busload of people suddenly pull up. I mean, most people, they would not have that same kind of reaction.
Well, and I really love her children. There are four of them talking about what it was to grow up in that scenario, right? To come home and to have 30 yeah. Italian bicyclists standing around.
There's some details in this story that I have to ask you about. Trout tricks. Like, she endeavored to teach trout tricks?
Yes.
Do you know any details about it? You know, you have so many parts in this book that, as a reader, you sort of just, what? Like, right. I want another whole book on trout tricks. I want another whole trout trick book.
Yeah, I love that there's this generation of Icelanders who grew up learning Danish because Iceland only became an independent nation after World War II. This is a recent thing. These people that will talk about, and even people that are maybe only in their 50s or 60s now, who will talk about there was nothing to do, right? There was no television, there was no radio.
So you collected stuff.
Napkin collections were a very big deal for us.
I know you wrote about that. Now, these are paper or cloth?
Paper, absolutely paper.
Really?
Right. There have to be the sort of thing that you could give away. I mean, it's a little bit like trick-or-treating, right? A bunch of children show up after an event asking if you have any napkins to spare. And, you know, you probably do. They take a few so they can trade them with their friends.
Wow.
And you quietly build this sort of alternate history of a place, right? Every baptism and wedding, but also, right, every club's tea or whatever was happening in town.
Jeez.
And so over with the trout tricks, right, this is an old country amusement. What are you going to do with your friends? Well, you can catch some fish, keep them alive, and with tiny bits of flies or insects or something to encourage them, try to get them to swim in circles or jump in the water or do whatever you might imagine a trout could do.
And I love the fact she did have all this other stuff there. She had all her other collections, pens, lighters, coasters. The way you just, to give the audience an example of your writing, I love the way that you describe the twin attractions. They're plainly extraordinary and terrifically familiar. Go ahead.
I was going to say, this is sort of a turning point for me in understanding how collections become museums and realizing that I think we like the narrative. It's an easy narrative to tell. Someone has been trying to write about this for a decade. I understand it's concise, it makes sense way of telling the story where there's one person who is obsessed with something and we end up with the collection that becomes the museum. But if you look, and I think, we can find these people in our own lives. If you look at collectors, the chances are they're interested in a whole bunch of stuff. Or maybe
so they're sort of almost genetic collectors.
I think that more than the noun of the thing that they're collecting, they're interested in the verb.
Right.
How they get it, how they amass it, what it is to keep something near you and know it for a while.
Now, you actually tried your hand at this.
I did.
I want you to describe to me in terrific detail how you did. So you walked the same trails she did.
I had a hard time making sense of it. The idea that this woman went on a walk most days of her life, right? That sounds right. I could see that. I could do that. But that she came back with something of note pretty much every walk. It seemed just amazing to me, right? And I was sort of trying to figure out, what was she seeing? I didn't expect to have anything like her luck, but I got instructions from the family. It still runs the place, right? They're in the kitchen. They're there in the gift shop. And a pair of granddaughters were explaining to me, you're just going to take this road out of town and you want to look for water, which is really easy. Iceland is a land of waterfalls and streams and, and you want water because it erodes the earth, right? It gets through all that vegetation and helps you see what's actually there. And there were plenty of little streams to pick from. I chose one that was a little bigger than the rest, but, you know, still nothing you would call so much as a creek, and started climbing up the mountain. There aren't a lot of fences. There aren't a lot of property lines you know about in Iceland. So I just started going and paying attention to what was there. And there was actually a lot to see. I was stunned that in some ways, really the hard part is not finding something amazing. It's finding sort of this Goldilocks moment, right? Not a stone that is too big or stuck into a cliff face, right? Not something too small that's going to sort of crumble in your hand. Finding something the right size to bring home. In some ways, that's the really amazing part of what she did. She found the specimen, the geology. Oh, my goodness. It's there for the taking.
Were most of the rocks the same size?
That's a good question. They talk about, right, there are 40 kilos, so like 90-pound stones that, thank goodness, they're steep hills. You can sort of roll them down.
Well, I mean, the stones in her collection, were they mostly like about the same size?
So they're these sort of famously big ones they brought back where you'd need to go get your son in a wash tub to bring it home.
Oh, wow. So she wasn't just sticking them in her pocket and taking them home.
No, I think if you tend to think of things in sort of the grapefruit to football size range, it's a commitment to bring it home. It's doable, but you'd have to decide it was worth it.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is A. Kendra Green, writer and artist who has worked at several museums over the years, but we're talking about her new book. It is a wonderful read. The Museum of Whales You Will Never See, and Other Excursions to Iceland's Most Unusual Museums. Ms. Green.
Yes.
Did you have a favorite museum?
Well, it's hard to pick amongst them.
Yeah, I know.
There are things I love for different reasons. I love the award-winning Herring Era Museum for bringing back a town and for giving me occasion to think about herring, which I promise you are absolutely fascinating.
Now, you're going to have to explain this because there was a whole era in Iceland's history where herring was king, queen, and the joker. I mean, it was like the gold rush. But that's over.
Yeah, well, 1903 to 1968, right, the herring peak. And then the next year, they just don't come. They're just gone. And the silver of the sea, which helps pull Iceland into the economic fortunes, right, make it look a lot more like the country we know now. You can imagine a town that was built out to process almost half the nation's catch, what it means when there's nothing left to do, right? There were so many abandoned buildings. The Siglafjordur Fire Department in the 1970s and 80s is famously the best fire department in the country for that period of time because they have so much to light on fire and burn down and practice putting out those fires.
One of the strangest moments in this rather strange book, and I mean that in a positive sense, was when you get to the Museum of Icelandic Sorcery and Witchcraft. And I'm just sort of reading along the sort of reader innocently in their soft chair at home. And I got to the description of the rib baby. I'm going to ask you to read that to give people an idea of the writing in this book.
Yeah, we're going off to Strander, famous sword sorcerers.
Yeah. And there's a rib baby. You dig up a corpse, you take a rib, you tie some material to it to create the smelcrum of a baby, and then what do?
But eventually, the rib baby will grow too big, will want too much, and you will find you can't support it. What can you do then but thank it for the cream that has been feeding your family? Look at it breathless from the raids and shoot it dead with a silver button.
Wow.
Perhaps you have no button. Perhaps you have no gun. Perhaps instead you give Rib Baby an impossible task. Send it to skin the cream from every farm in the country.
Wow.
You know when you say it. You hope when you say it. That it will exhaust itself and die in a field before it ever makes it home. Maybe when you went to the grave, you saved another rib for later.
Wow. When I get to that section of the book is when the poverty, because as you write after every section, and there's some pretty gruesome sections with the necropants, the poor always have options. And that's essentially what that museum is about. Is what are your options if you don't have a lot?
Right. If you have faced not just a series of hard winters, but a series of hard summers, right?
Yeah.
You are starving. What do you do? I think it's so interesting how, so grimoires are the books of magic that come down mm-hmm. to us. They're always copied by hand because they were generally illegal to possess, right? You could be punished, even killed, for having them. There are descriptions of punishments that involve being beaten or whipped across your back while pages of the book are burned beneath your nose. And if you look at the magic that people were attempting, so much of it is about trying to know a thief, right? Trying to get back what you have lost, not even trying to accumulate great fortunes.
It's almost like just to try to stay alive. I mean, you're getting this rib baby to steal cream so your baby can live.
And think about it, right, as a metaphor for motherhood, right, that this is a deal that people have had to make across time in desperate circumstances, right? Does the baby live or does the mother?
Now, there's so many odd things that go on in this book, and there are so many interesting things that you write. One of them is that they say the thing that changes Iceland was the rubber boot.
It's documented in an amazing photo essay, this idea that a lot changes as the British and the American forces occupy the island. It coincides with telecommunication and transportation, but also just sort of material stuff. The curator of the Phallological Museum talks about the young men during the war and after, and how these were soldiers in uniforms and manners with bubblegum. How could they compete?
Wow.
So imagine that one of the things the military brings is the rubber boot. This is a nation of farmers and fishermen for basically forever, right? The 1,000 years of inhabitation. And it's never been a really easy thing to have shoes in Iceland. It just takes a lot of material. The volcanic earth will slice it to ribbons. So traditionally you have these basically little slipper-like things, not very much shoe at all. And then imagine the rubber boot. Imagine having dry feet for the first time in 1,000 years. And they say it's documented that there were some people who just found it eerie, right? Just too strange and foreign and alien, and would correct the situation by adding a little water into the boot.
That's so bizarre.
And yet not that long ago, right?
I know. Well, most of the museums that you talk about in this book only came into being as public attractions in the last 30 years?
And possibly less, yeah, right? If you think about it, the second museum ever established in Iceland, the original curator is still alive. I mean, granted, he's turned 99 in April, but he only retired a couple of years ago and is still sort of the heart and soul of this institution, right? That you go to see the 15,000 objects telling you the history of a nation, but you also go because this one person has been responsible, right? Can look at you and tell you your grandmother gave this blanket, or right, work out the genealogy and call a cousin a couple of fjords over that you didn't know you had because he's been keeping track of so much and so many people for so long.
And most people should realize we're not talking, these museums that we're talking about are not located in or near Reykjavik. Some of these museums are way the hell in the middle of nowhere.
You can go around the entire island, and I do mean around because no one lives in the Highlands. You can circumnavigate this coast and find a museum in maybe every other town you stop in.
Wow.
They're wildly decentralized.
But getting there, I mean, some of them in the far eastern part of the island just seemed like getting there is an adventure, let alone seeing the collection once you do get there.
No question about it. There was a point where I was organizing the book when I was thinking, I could talk about a different mode of transportation in each section because there's the place you have to fly to, and there's the place you have to drive to, and there's the place that gets you there by bus. There was a year where I was trying to make it from the town of Flateri in the Vestfjords because it was 201 people with, depending on how you count, 5 museums, 6 if you count the one at the edge of town, 7 if you count the first one established in 1993 and then buried under an avalanche in 1995.
Oh, wow.
And to get from there to the Sea Monster Museum in Bildudalur, I was working on this complicated series of buses, and the people I was staying with said, you should just hitchhike. I don't know how to do that. And I don't even have the material. I couldn't make a sign. And they said, so you need a sign. And by the time I got back from the swimming pool, which is what you do in Iceland, it's my personal mantra, when in doubt, seek out hot water. I came back from the local pool, and their 8-year-old daughter had made me a rainbow sign announcing that I, in fact, wanted to go to Bildudalur. And they weren't wrong. It turned out it took two legs and a nervous hour and a half at a very big waterfall, hoping someone would pick me up. But they were right. It was, in fact, the easiest way to get to the next place I needed to be.
Did that mean you had to hitch out?
I did. And
wow.
I think it's interesting. No one, well, particularly as a woman traveling alone, I feel like I grew up with the idea of hitchhiking is a thing of the past.
Yep,
we don't do it. It's dangerous because of the person that will pick you up. And if you're focused on that, you will miss the whole fact that you're standing at the side of a road. It's cold and drizzly. I was working on a bit of a cold at the time anyway. Ooh. So I was thinking, it's a mile back into town. This wasn't necessarily the best idea. But then a pair of Czech tourists and then an Icelandic family on vacation said, you know what? We've got room. I'm sure we're going where you're going. And it took care of itself.
We're completely out of time, and we barely have talked about this book. It's just a marvelous book. We didn't even talk about the national handball team, which I want to talk about.
Our silver boys. I know. How does a nation that fits in one phone book make a silver medaling Olympic team? It's incredible.
Those are stories for other time. You have to read the book. My guest tonight is Ms. A. Kendra Green, writer and artist. And she's worked in several museums and brought all that experience with her to research her latest book, which is just a great read, The Museum of Whales You Will Never See, and Other Excursions to Iceland's Most Unusual Museums. Kendra, it's been a real pleasure.
Oh, I can't wait to pick up the conversation again at some point in the future. Thanks so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.